Last week, you'll recall, we talked a lot about the dynamical evolution of quantum systems, time evolution of an isolated quantum system. We talked also about various other kinds of transformations that the quantum system might undergo. For example, we talked a lot about rotation, and we talked about the idea of a symmetry, which is a kind of a state transformation that commutes with the time evolution. And we also talked about path integrals, which is a way of getting at the time evolution operator for systems with a continuous degree of freedom, like a particle moving in one dimension, is what we talked about. And of course, the path integral is a the first piece of a much larger development, a much more extensive rethinking of quantum theory, and you'll see that later on this year, I bet. Okay, so I suppose I should ask if there are any questions on that, but are there any short questions on what we did last week? All right. this week, we're going to consider quantum systems that are no longer alone. We're going to consider systems that are composed of larger composite systems, systems that are subsystems, parts of larger composite systems, and what comes from that. And we'll also consider quantum systems that may be interacting with their surroundings, and what comes from that. And so that's a reasonably important piece of the quantum theory. But some of the things that we'll talk about this week are not traditional parts of your first introduction to quantum theory that you might have seen as an undergraduate. So I hope that everybody will see something new, completely new to them this week. Okay, so today I want to start by talking about composite quantum systems. Okay, so if you have a quantum system A, and it's described by some Hilbert space, so the states of the quantum system are vectors. Here's the state of A, and I'll use little superscripts in parentheses to denote what system I'm talking about when that's necessary. And this is some element of a Hilbert space for system A. And maybe there's a system B. My systems tend to be little boxes. It's got some state phi B, which is an element, a normalized vector in a Hilbert space describing B. That's Hilbert space B. Okay, you got these two guys. Then what happens when you consider them together? What happens when you consider these two pieces of the physical world as a single quantum system, the system AB? Well, then you're going to have quantum states describing this thing, which will be state vectors, perhaps. I'll try to use capital letters for composite systems just to help us keep track of what's going on. A state of the composite system AB will be an element of some Hilbert space for the system AB. So the first question is, what's this? What's this? How is this Hilbert space related to these Hilbert spaces? If I understand the quantum mechanics of a spin 1/2 particle and I understand the quantum mechanics of another spin 1/2 particle, what is the arena for the quantum mechanics of the pair of spins? And the answer is that that is a tensor product space. And this is a notion, this tensor product notion is one that is related to, but not identical with, but really, really closely related to, the kinds of things you talk about in relativity, and after a little bit maybe you'll have some questions about what the connection is, this space, Hilbert space describing the composite system, is what we might call Hilbert space A, tensor product Hilbert space B. I haven't told you what this is, but let me tell you what's in this. Let me tell you what's in this space. What does this space contain? It contains what are called product vectors. A product vector is a vector for space A. Tensor product is that symbol again. Some vector for state B. If you give me a vector for state A and a vector for state B, a vector in HA and a vector in HB, then there is a vector in HAB, which is just the tensor product of these two, meaning to be illuminated in a minute. The second thing is, it's a this is a linear space. It's a vector space, and so it contains not just these things, but also linear combinations of these things, superpositions of them. Okay, linear combinations. Contains linear combinations of product vectors, some of which are not themselves product vectors. So this sort of extends the space a little bit. And then three, very importantly, crucially, it contains nothing else. Okay? Nothing else. So another way of thinking about it is that this thing is the smallest vector space that contains all of these guys. The smallest vector space that contains all of these guys. So it contains all these guys. It contains everything that you get by linear combinations of these guys, and that's it. Okay, so some things to note. Notes. Okay, first things to note. Yeah, I've got my crumbly chalk again. First thing to note is what we might call compact notation. These expressions can get pretty big. So for example, I have this product vector. Well, you know, if I have a product vector like this, it saves us a little bit of chalk and room, and it does not cause things to be less clear if I just call this psi A phi B. When I write something like that, I mean this tensor product, but I just want to write it in a more compact way. This says, yes, there's this vector for A and this vector for B. And I do the tensor product thing. And when there's no possibility of confusion, I might omit the superscripts telling me what states these are from. If I always know, for example, that I'm talking about composite states, or I'm talking about states of a composite system, and I write down something like this, then this is the first system, that's the second system, and there's got to be some sort of understood order that I'm talking about the systems in. And so this is, I hope, a lot more compact than this. But if this is ever unclear, then I suggest you go in and fill these in yourself, which will make it more clear. And then if that doesn't make it clear, you can always expand out to something like this. Okay? All right, so that's the first thing to note, that we will sometimes use a more compact notation. Second thing is that this tensor product operation, it acts like a product in the sense that it distributes over a linear combination. So just to take a simple example, if I looked at psi tensor A1 phi 1 plus A2 phi 2, and I've left as an exercise in the compact notation, I've left off the superscript here. This is for A. Both of these guys are for B. They have to live in the same Hilbert space because I'm adding them. This is equal to A1 times the tensor product of psi with phi 1 plus A2 times the tensor product of psi with phi 2. That's it distributes. And it distributes in the other direction as well. So it acts just like a multiplication in a certain sense, which is why we think of it as a product. And you can extend this to larger expressions by linearity. Another thing is an inner product. If this is a Hilbert space, it had better come equipped with an inner product between vectors. Okay? Now, because everything is either a product vector and a superposition, a linear combination of product vectors, it'll be enough to tell you how the inner product works on product vectors, and then say just extend that by linearity. Right? Because the inner product is linear in the second place, the ket place, and conjugate linear in the first place, the bra place. So an inner product. And I'll just tell you that the inner product of psi phi, a product vector, with psi prime, phi prime, another product vector, that's just equal to the inner product of psi with psi prime times the inner product of phi with phi prime. This, of course, is an inner product. This, of course, is a complex number. It's an inner product in HA. This is an inner product in HB. This is an inner product in HAB. And this is simply the product of these complex numbers. And given that you can take the inner product of any product vectors, you can now take the inner product of any vectors because it just extends by linearity. Extend by linearity. We're going to do that trick a few times. I'm going to tell you how things work for product vectors. But of course, there are things in there that aren't product vectors, as we will show. But they don't produce, they don't cause any additional difficulties because you just write the things that are not product vectors as sums of product vectors and then deal with the terms individually. And by the way, since you can write everything as a linear combination of product vectors, it means you can do something. Have a very nice representation in terms of a product basis. So suppose I have bases, and of course I always mean orthonormal bases unless otherwise stated. Suppose I have bases, the A vectors are bases for HA, and the B vectors form a basis for HB. Remember, these guys don't live in the same Hilbert space necessarily. These might be quite different Hilbert spaces. Okay. Well, then I can get a basis for the tensor product space, which is composed of all products of these individual basis vectors. All the tensor products of all the basis vectors. So, by the way, the fact that this is a basis tells you immediately what the dimension of the space is. The dimension of the tensor product space is the product of the dimension of one space and the dimension of the other. So, if this is a 5-dimensional space and that's a 7-dimensional space, then this is a 35-dimensional space. And so if I have some vector, I can of course expand it in terms of the product basis, which means I'll need to do a sum over both A and B, over the joint index AB, if you will, of some coefficient psi AB times the AB basis vectors, of course. And then these guys, in the usual way, can be given by inner products with the basis vectors because they're orthonormal. psi AB is nothing but AB inner product with psi. And then I can compute, if I compute the inner product using this rule, that's perfectly clear. Okay, now I've talked about all these things about the vectors. What about quantum states? This is some notes about the idea of the tensor product space, and we'll talk more about structures having to do with the tensor product space. What about quantum states? Well, if A is in a state psi A, and B is in the state phi B, so if I can, if I based on the preparation of the system, I can ascribe this definite state to system A and this definite state to system B, then the joint state, the joint or the composite system, is in the joint state psi AB, which is simply the product of these guys, the tensor product of these pieces. It's a product state. It's a product state. Quantum states, in which I can assign definite states to the individual subsystems, those are product states. But this is not exhaustive. There are other states which are not product states. I said all along that not every vector in HAB is a product vector. It might be a linear combination of product vectors, but not itself a product vector. And so if it's not a product state, if it's otherwise, okay, psi AB is an entangled state. Now notice the entangled state is kind of odd. If you were in an entangled state, this would mean that you could not ascribe definite state vectors to either of the subsystems, because if you can assign definite state vectors to the subsystems, you can ascribe a product state to the whole thing. But if you're not in a product state, it means you can't assign state vectors to the subsystems. The subsystems don't have definite quantum state vectors. And this right away is a new thing in quantum theory. In classical physics, tell you what the state of a composite system is, I have to tell you the state of the individual pieces. To tell you what the configuration of 16 particles is, I have to tell you the location of every one of those 16 particles. And in phase space, if I have to tell you the point in phase space describing the state of those 16 particles, that point in phase space specifies the position and momentum of each particle. But quantum mechanically, the state of a composite system might not entail definite states of the subsystems. And so that's something quite different in quantum theory than in classical physics. Okay, so if I have any joint state, of course I can write it. Write this joint state. I want to tell you how to recognize an entangled state when you see one. Okay, so here's my joint state, and it's equal to the sum over A and B. And I'm going to be expansive in my notation for the moment. I've got psi AB times the A basis vector for A tensor the B basis vector for B, and I sum over A and B. But, of course, this tensor product stuff is distributive, so I can write that in a kind of a neat way. I can write that as the sum over A of the A basis vector tensor the sum over B of psi AB, the B basis vector for B. And this guy right here, is a vector for each A, it's a vector for the system B. It's a vector in the Hilbert space for B. So I'll call this psi sub A of B. And that tells me that this is the sum over A of A tensor psi sub A. And I've just dropped a few indices here to tell you which subsystems are which. I got tired of writing them. And I can always do this. And these guys right here are not necessarily normalized vectors. In fact, some of them might be zero. Okay? These are not necessarily normalized vectors, but there are some vectors. There are a bunch of vectors like this, one for each basis element for A. So I can write this in this way. I can always do that. So what if the composite state is a product state? What if I got a product vector? So if psi AB is equal to psi phi, well, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to expand psi in terms of the A basis. I'm going to expand this first vector in terms of the A basis. So that's going to be the sum over A of little psi sub A. And now this is a complex number, not a designation for a vector, of A, all of that, tensor phi for B, which is the sum over A, the A vector, tensor psi sub A times phi. So these are all these guys. Okay? These guys right here, these are the psi sub A vectors. So if you have a product state, all of these guys, if I write it in that form, and the significance of that form will get really clear later on. If I write it in that form, all of these guys, all of the B vectors, which are not orthogonal to each other necessarily and might not be normalized, but all of them are multiples of the same vector. If that's the case, then it's a product state. So if psi A equals some number times, which is always the same, then phi is a product state. Okay, so to explain how this works, let me give you a couple of examples really quick. Simple examples, because I don't want to spend a lot of time. And I don't know if I've done this much before, but I will often, for examples, reach to something we're going to talk about a lot next week. That is to say, we'll reach to qubits. And for qubits, qubits are things which have the dimension of their Hilbert space is 2. And I'll often use a basis where I'll designate 0 and 1 as a sort of a special standard basis for my qubit. And this might be a spin. And this might be spin up and spin down. Or it might be a two-level atom, and this is a ground state, and this is an excited state. Or it might be a particle in an interferometer, a two-beam interferometer arrangement. This is the state where the particle's in the one beam, this is the state where the particle's in the other beam, or anything like that. This is just a nice abstract notation, which allows me to write down an example without confusing you with a lot of physics. So let's imagine in our example we have 2 qubits, okay? And my first joint state is just going to be 1/2 times the sum of all the the product standard basis vectors. And if I write that in this form, in this good form, then that's going to be 0 tensor 1/2 0 plus 1 for the second guy. That's the first two terms, the ones with 0 in the first place, plus 1 tensor product with 1/2 0 plus 1. Okay, and so these two guys are both multiples of the same vector, right? They're multiples of the same vector. In fact, they are the same vector. So this is a product state. And in fact, you don't have to be a rocket scientist or even a quantum physicist to figure out how to write this. This is, of course, 1 over the square root of 2, 0 plus 1, tensor product 1 over the square root of 2, 0 plus 1. Okay, these are A and B states, which give me this as the product state. But now let's consider a slightly different example, where I have 1/2 and I have 0, 0 plus 0, 1 plus 1, 0 minus 1, 1. In fact, it's just like the previous example, except I've changed this plus sign to a minus sign. Then when I do this expansion, I get 0 tensor product with 1/2 0 plus 1 for the second qubit, plus 1 for the first qubit, tensor product with 1/2 0 minus 1. I need a minus sign here to get this sign correct. And these guys are not the same. These guys in the square brackets are not the same, and so this must be entangled. This is an entangled state. I can't write this as the tensor product of two single system vectors. I can just say that. I can tell that because this and this are linearly independent vectors. They're not multiples of the same vector. Okay? Questions about this? So it's great. We know how to recognize an entangled state when we see one. We simply expand it in this form for any old basis that we pick for A, for the first system. We expand it in this form, and then we see if these guys are all multiples of the same vector. Yeah?
If the two spaces don't have the same dimension, should we be careful about expanding one way or the other?
No. There's no need. In fact, if they have a different dimension, I suggest you do this trick at expanding with the smaller dimension, so there'll be fewer terms. But no, there's no need to do this. This works all the time. I'm making no assumptions about the relative sizes of the Hilbert space. You can always do such an expansion. Okay? Which is cool. Okay? Now, in a couple of days, you'll understand some things. So for example, if A has a Hilbert space of dimension 2, and B has a Hilbert space of dimension 3, and I expand it this way, there are only two terms in the sum, and so that means, in some sense, these guys can't kind of fill up the space. But that turns out to be right. So, okay. All right. Now let's, let's see, what do I want to do? Examples. Okay. Oh, let's talk about physics. Let's talk about measurements. Measurements and probabilities. Of course, you know sort of the general way of thinking about measurement in quantum mechanics. And at least for today, I want to think in terms at least for a little bit, I want to think in terms not of observables, which are represented by Hermitian operators that have, because they have real eigenvalues corresponding to possible values of a particular dynamical observable, but take a little bit more primitive notion of measurement, which is what we might call a basic measurement. A basic measurement. And a basic measurement is associated with a basis. An orthonormal basis, okay? And each basis vector corresponds to a possible result of the measurement. And this basis might be the eigenbasis of an operator, and the result might be the eigenvalues, okay? But these guys are the possible results of my measurement process. Of my measurement process. And then the as I said, this might be the eigenbasis for some observable without degeneracy. And so then if I measure the value of that observable, the numerical value I get will tell me a particular basis vector that I'm associated with. And of course, we know that the rule, the probability rule in quantum mechanics, is simply that I take the probability amplitude for this. I take the inner product of the basis vector with the state, and I take the square of its magnitude. And that's the probability rule in quantum mechanics for one of these measurements. It's the Born rule, sort of in disguise. Sorry, probability of k, of course. Probability of k, of course. That's the Born rule. The probability of k is simply the square of the magnitude of the inner product of k with psi. Okay, so with this notion of measurement, which is kind of a primitive notion, but you can see you could use it to build up the idea of a numerical observable assigning values, and then you could build the operator associated with it. Starting with this, we say that we can have a joint measurement on a composite system. Among the measurements that you can make on a composite system, there are measurements which correspond to making one measurement on one system and another measurement on another system. Okay? There are other measurements that are not like that. But at least one kind of measurement procedure is to take your two subsystems and make separate independent measurements on them. So we can have a basis A corresponding to outcomes of a measurement on system A, and we can have a state B which corresponds to measurement on system B, and then that gives me the joint basis. That gives me the joint basis, and that gives me that the probability of the joint outcome A and B, the probability that the measurement result on the first system gives me A and the measurement result on the second system gives me B, that probability is simply the inner product of the product basis state with my joint quantum state magnitude squared. Okay? Now notice what this means. Notice what this means for a product state, for example. Suppose I have a product state, and I looked at AB inner product psi phi squared. That's my joint probability. But of course, this inner product is by our inner product rule, is going to be the product of a couple of inner products. We have a product of a couple of complex numbers. There's going to be the inner product of A with psi times the inner product of B with phi. Of course, also, when you take the product of two complex numbers, the magnitude is just the product of the magnitudes of those complex numbers. And so this is just equal to in this one, of course, B phi magnitude squared. And we recognize this as being the probability that quantum mechanics predicts for the A outcome, given that the first system is in the state psi. So this is just the probability of that outcome. This is just the probability of that outcome, and you just multiply them together. Which means, in a statistical sense, if the two systems are in a product state, then the measurement outcomes are independent, random variables. The probabilities just multiply. So there are no correlations between systems in a product state. Okay, questions about this? Okay, let me show you a neat trick. Okay, the neat trick is called the partial inner product. And the idea is something like this. If I have some alpha A, I can take a kind of inner product with a state of AB. And the result is not a scalar, but is a vector in the Hilbert space for B. Okay? So this is from the Hilbert space for A. This is from that tensor product space, the Hilbert space for AB. It makes sense to take the tensor product of these two guys and call it a vector in B. And how does that work? Well, I'll tell you how it works for a product state. If psi AB is a product of A and B vectors, then this partial inner product with that product state is just the inner product of the A vector with sort of the A part of that state all times phi B. This, of course, is just a complex number, and so this whole thing is an element of B, of HB. And so we can, of course, extend by linearity. We can extend that notion by linearity. I told you how it works for product states. Now you can extend it to any kind of state. And so that's pretty cool. And in fact, it's pretty cool right here. Because in this way of expanding this joint state. Because if I look at this joint state, I can spot what would happen if I took the inner product of this with one of the A basis vectors. And what would happen is I just take in each term the inner products here. I get a delta. I get a delta function between like A and A prime, and that would kill all the terms except one. And I would wind up with the fact that this psi A is exactly the partial inner product of A, which is a I'll put in the subsystem labels. That I can write this exactly as a partial inner product. As a partial inner product of the basis vector for A with the joint state. So these guys right here have a neat mathematical representation. Those things in that expansion that was so handy. Now, let's think about what happens if we take this guy written in this form and we make a joint measurement on it. Let's suppose we make a joint measurement on that state. Then the probability of AB is equal to magnitude of AB psi magnitude squared, but I can do the partial inner product sort of one, the inner product one piece at a time. I can first do the inner product with the A guy. And this will become the inner product of just B with psi sub B. Inner product of B with psi sub B. So this is kind of neat. By taking an inner product within B, once I've got an expansion like this, by taking the inner product within B, I can tell you the joint probability of A and B. So let me write that down. I guess I did. How about the probability of A by itself? You know, I can no longer, if this were a product state, I'd have something simple. If this were a product state, it'd have something simple. But I can no longer say that because I'm not making any assumptions that my composite state is a product state. What can I have? Well, it's a rule of probability that you can get the probability of one variable by simply summing the joint probability over the other variable. So this is the sum over all the possible values of B of P AB. Yeah?
A, not
psi B. Oh yes, of course, because it had better be dependent both on A and B. Quite right, and thank you. That would be very confusing. Okay. Okay, so I sum that. It's the sum over B of this guy. But you can see this is the sum of the squares of the magnitudes of the components of psi sub A with respect to the B basis. This is in fact just psi A inner product with itself. So that's pretty neat. These psi sub A's, which I get by the partial inner product, have built into them the probability of the outcome of A. These things are not normalized. They're, if you will, normalized by the probability P sub A. That's pretty cool. But wait, there's more. It's also interesting to talk about conditional probabilities. If you guys are familiar with the notion of conditional probability, I can imagine two variables, like whether or not it rains and whether or not it I have a flat tire. And the two things might be related, because if it rains, I'm more likely to drive, and so more likely to get a flat tire. And so in order to calculate, I can calculate the probability that it rains, I can calculate the probability that I have a flat tire, I can calculate the joint probabilities that it rains or not, that it has a flat tire, that it has a flat, I have a flat tire or not. But I can also calculate a conditional probability. What's the probability that, given that it's raining, I will have a flat tire? And we write that this way: the probability of B given A. This is the probability of this given that, the vertical line that separates the things you're finding the probability of from the things that you're assuming are true. Okay? And it turns out the rules of probability tell you that this is just the joint probability of A and B divided by the probability of A. Notice that this is not defined if the probability of A is 0, but that's okay. If the probability of A is 0, this condition will never arise, and so you don't ever have to calculate that probability. Okay, so let's see what this is. Well, that's a 1 over probability of A, which is the normalization of that, times this partial inner product squared. So this motivates us to define a normalized vector, psi sub A. It's a vector in B. I'll just write that here to remind you. Psi sub A, and it's normalized, so I'm going to put a hat over it. I use hats for all kinds of things. And that's equal to 1 over the square root of this probability of A times this state psi sub A. It's not really a state, it's just a vector because it's subnormalized. But this is normalized. This is normalized. And then the probability of B given A is just the Born rule for the normalized state psi A hat. And this, I can define this for this state without even knowing what I'm going to measure for B. And once I find what this is, I can predict the outcome, the measurement results of any measurement that I make on B, given that I got this result for the A state. So let me tell you what the moral of this story is. This is very cool. The moral of the story is that I can write psi AB as the sum over A of A tensor psi sub AB. And this is given by a partial inner product. A with psi for the state AB. Okay. That's the first thing. That the joint probability the probability that I get the result A, the probability that I get the result A is simply given by psi A inner product with itself. That probability is in here. And given that I've gotten A, then I can tell you that there's a state, if I get the result A, I can tell you there's a state of system B. There's a particular state of system B. What's that state? That state is this state. This is the state of system B. Why do I know that? Because I know it correctly predicts any probability of any measurement that I might make on B, given that the result A took place. So I have the conditional state. I'll put a hat over it to remind myself that I'm normalizing it, which is just the normalized version of this thing I got by partial inner product. So these guys really do tell me a lot. They tell me what the probabilities of the A results are, and they tell me what the state of B will be, given that I have various possibilities. So this is cool. This is cool. Questions about this? Yeah?
The next would be A.
Shouldn't this be, I'm sorry, what? No,
there, on the side, yes?
The psi, it should be sub A, of course. It's given A. Psi sub A. Thank you. Oh, A's and B's. Good. I'm encouraged. So far, I don't think that I've made any errors that you haven't caught. What? Another one? Which one? No. No! The square is already in the fact that both of these guys appear like this. It already has, this already has the components of this magnitude squared. If I wrote this in terms of the B basis, I'd get things times their complex conjugates. It would be this. This is already that. If you want to look at it, I can write it as B psi A B B psi A. It's a little more obvious when I write it this way. That's obviously this, and it's obviously that by completeness. So there's no square. It's already there. Okay. Yeah?
Aren't the psi A's originally normalized?
No, the psi A's are not originally normalized. They're just whatever I get. They're just whatever I get over here. And these capital psi's may be normalized, and since if I sum the squares of their magnitudes, I get 1. But for each individual A, I don't sum them all up. I only sum a few of them. So these things are in general subnormalized. Okay? And so this is an example of a place where non-normalized states tell you a lot. They actually are really convenient. They're a convenient way of talking about this because they, in this expansion, they encode not only what the conditional state of B is if I happen to get the A measurement result for A, they also tell me what the probability of that measurement result is, because that's encoded in the normalization. Yeah.
And PA is then the probability for measuring A, no matter
on
what
the first system. The probability that I get the result A on my measurement of the first system.
Right.
Yeah.
But I thought we can't distinguish between the two systems.
You can't distinguish? Why not?
I don't know.
Because I'm not making any assumption that these guys are identical particles or anything. One of them could be a spin degree of freedom. The other could be the three-dimensional motion of the particle. Those would be different subsystems. I'm not making any such assumption. Okay? In fact, I'm sort of assuming that by saying that there are two degrees of freedom, that I have physical means of addressing those degrees of freedom independently. Okay? So I'm imagining that I can do different measurements, a joint measurement, a measurement of this on one and another measurement perhaps on the other. So this sort of assumes that these things are independently manipulable in the laboratory. Yes?
So the issue starts that you find out that if you've just got one particle, you find out that it's entangled with another particle. If you've got a particle in system A, you can find out that you're entangled on system B. You didn't already know that. So they show that.
Oh, well, if they weren't entangled, they would be in a product state. And if they were in a product state, I would find that joint distribution over measurement outcomes, no matter which measurements I chose, would always be product distribution. They would be independent random variables. That would be what a product a state would be. If I have reason to believe that the joint system can be described by a state vector, and now that I found out that you can't always assign a state vector to a quantum system because it might be entangled with something else. But if I have reason to believe that this joint system can be described by a single state vector, then any deviation from this, any correlation between measurement results, would be a sign of entanglement. Okay?
Okay. If you just have, you're making observations on system A.
Okay.
You think maybe someone's entangled with another system called system B. Can you find out if you're entangled with it?
Nope. Not without accessing system B.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you might, as we'll see, come to a reasonable belief that A is entangled with something.
Okay.
But you can't tell what.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So you'll work out an example of this this afternoon.
Is there any way to quantify entanglement?
Yes.
Oh.
Many, many ways. Okay. We won't consider any of the sophisticated ones, but maybe we'll talk about that later. So how much entanglement? Yeah, there's a way to talk about how much entanglement. But in fact, the notion of entanglement may be too complex a notion to be summarized by a single quantity. And certainly that's true if you have more than two systems. Yeah?
What's the difference between entanglement and correlation?
Ah! Correlation is a statement that you might make about random variables, about the results of some measurement. And for the case of states described by a joint state vector, and as we'll find out, that's not the only situation, then correlation is the mark of entanglement. Correlation results from entanglement. But entanglement is a statement about the underlying quantum state. Correlation is a word that I would reserve for correlations between observables, between results of possible measurements. But entanglement is a specific thing, which is that not every quantum state is a product state. From this, we'll generalize all these notions. But that's what the that's what our definition is for.
Yeah.
I mean, the example you showed us, the entangled state had two orthogonal states coupled to each other. So, does it always have to be orthogonal states?
Example, I showed you two orthogonal. Does it always have to be orthogonal states? No, is the short answer. The larger answer is no, but there's a special, if you choose your basis right, you can always arrange that to happen. But we'll talk about that later in the week. Other questions? Okay, so we want to talk about operators. And operators are really simple, and you can sort of guess how it works. I can tell you what I mean by the tensor product of two operators. That F tensor G, where this is a one from system A and this is for system B, acting on a product state, will simply be the product of F acting on psi tensor G acting on phi. And then you can extend this to, by linearity, to entangled states or to operators that are sums of tensor products of operators. Not every operator is a tensor product of two operators for the subsystems. There are others that are much more complicated, but every one of them, in fact, can be written as a sum of things like this. To give you a good example of how this works out. Tell you something about the idea of adding spins. Let me tell you a little bit about what happens when you have more than one spin. I'm skipping over another example, which I hope to come back to give you at the beginning of class next time. But let's talk about adding spins. I'm going to let h bar equal 1 again. Tomorrow I'm going to let 1 half equal 1 as well. What we have in our mind is that if I have two spins, this is what I'm thinking, that the spin vectors are the sum of the individual spin vectors, the vector sum. And what I really mean by that is, for example, that the total spin of two systems is the spin of one of them plus the spin of the other, etc. Okay? I get spin components by adding the corresponding spin components for the individual systems. Now these individual systems, 1 and 2, are parts of a composite system. So for example, let's consider the commutation relation between the total spin x and the total spin y. Well, that's the total spin x for system 1 plus the total spin y for system 1, total spin x for system 2 plus the total spin, I'm being very stupid. It's x for system 1 plus x for system 2, y for system 1 plus y for system 2. There we go. And now I do this. Now, what about this? How do I interpret this? How do I interpret this? If I'm adding two operators that are not even operators on the same space, what does that mean? What does that mean? How do I add two operators that aren't even operators on the same space? Well, I have to interpret them as being operators on the same space. Okay? I have to interpret both of these guys as being operators on the joint space. And so this gives me a clue about how to do it. If I only wanted F here, if I only wanted F to act on psi but nothing to happen to phi, then what would I do? Right, I'd FA is going to be really FA tensor the identity on B. And GB is equal to the identity on A, tensor G, B. And this is what I mean by these operators as operators on the joint system. And once I have something like this, I can add them. I can multiply them together. When I multiply these guys together, does it matter which order I multiply them? No, because F always commutes with this, and this always commutes with that. So the operators on two of the two subsystem operators always commute with each other. That means that in this commutator, there are only two terms that are non-zero. That's where SX is commuting with SY for system one, and the other one where SX is commuting with SY for system two. The other guys are automatically zero because they are things like this, and it doesn't matter which order you write, you do that multiplication, you always get the same thing. Okay, so I get SX1, SY1 plus SX2 commuted with SY2, which gives me I times SZ1 plus SZ2, which is I times SZ, which is very gratifying. I get the right commutation relations for the total spin. By the way, here's a little exercise for you. Okay? Here you go. You ready for this? Suppose I were trying to make a different linear combination of spins, a different linear combination of spins, where I put in some coefficients here. So that means that these guys would be defined with coefficients alpha and beta here. Okay? Same alpha and beta for all three components. Now require that I get the right commutation relations for angular momentum for the total. Then you can prove that there are only three possibilities. It's where this is one and this is zero. That is to say, you just have spin of the first guy. This is zero, this is one. And where they're both one. It's the only linear combination that acts like an angular momentum that involves actually both of them. That's kind of a cool problem. But anyway, so if you're dying for an extra problem, here's one for you. All right, so let's suppose that we have two spin 1/2 particles. That is to say, S1 is equal to 1/2, and M1 is therefore equal to plus or minus 1/2. S2 is equal to 1/2, and so M2 is equal to plus or minus 1/2. If I write it in terms of eigenvalues of these of the total spin for the individual guys and the z component of spin for these guys, and I can write my possible basis vectors as up, up down, down, up, and down, down, respectively. And I can find out what the total spin in the z direction is for each of these guys, remembering that the total m has to equal m1 plus m2 because the total z component of angular momentum is just the sum of the individual components of angular momentum. So Sz acting on up, up, what do I get? Well, Sz1 acting on this guy will give me plus 1/2 times this. And SZ2 acting on this guy will give me plus 1/2 times this. So this just gives me plus 1 times this. And SZ acting on up down, well, let's see. This gives me a plus 1/2 from the first guy and a minus 1/2 for the second guy. This gives me 0. It's also true that SZ acting on down up gives me 0. And SZ acting on down down gives me a minus 1/2 for each of the two parts of this operator, and therefore minus 1 acting on down down. So so this tells me that if I'm looking at so I want to find out What about the SM values, the values of the quantum number SM for S squared and SZ, the total angular momentum variables? And here, I can tell you something about the M values. I've got a plus one here, I've got a couple of zeros, I've got a minus one. Now, we know that angular momentum states, eigenstates of both S squared and SZ, fall into ladders of various sorts. We know this guy, for example, this M equal to minus one state, must be the bottom rung of a ladder, since it's the bottom state here, must be the bottom rung of a ladder with S equal to 1. This is the bottom rung of an S equal to 1 ladder. Okay, so let's see if that actually works out. Now, we're going to say that the S equal 1, M equal minus 1 state, therefore, is just down, down. And we're going to build the rest of this ladder by applying S plus. Now, remember that S plus, acting on M or SM, will give me something with the same S and an M that's 1 bigger, and 1 over the square root of S times S plus 1 minus M times M plus 1. We wrote that down before. Or the zero vector. And so let's construct the rest of these guys by applying the ladder operator. Well, what's this ladder operator? Of course, S plus is going to be equal to SX plus ISY, which is equal to S plus for system 1 plus S plus for system 2. The ladder operator for the overall system is the sum of the ladder operators for the individual spins. Yeah?
It's just square root inverse.
No, you're quite right. I've written it the wrong way around. What I really meant to say is, you're quite right that this is true. Why? M over n plus 1. That is to say that if it exists, okay, if this is non-zero, then I can define this term this way. Because this is really how I want to use it. And of course, that's why it's 1 over the square root. Thank you. So, what this tells me is how to write down the S equal to 1, M equal to 0 state. That's just equal to S plus times down, down. But S plus is just S plus 1, acting on down, down, plus S plus 2, acting on down, down. It turns out that for the spin 1/2 particles, there's no funny prefactor. The prefactor is just 1. It turns out to be 1. And so this tells me this is, I forgot this. 1 over the square root of S times S plus 1. Well, S is equal to 1, so that's 2, minus M is this guy, minus 1 times minus 1 plus 1, which is 0. Okay, so I've got 1 over the square root of 2. Well, 1 over the square root of 2 times, well, if I apply S plus to this, what do I get? S plus of 1 to this. S plus of spin 1. If I have the raising operator to spin 1, what do I get? Applying it to down, down. Up, down, exactly. It's just up, down. And it turns out that the numerical factor is 1. And here, I get... Yeah, I get down, up. And so this tells me what S equal to 1, the M equal to 0 state is. It tells me it's this guy. It tells me exactly what total spin 1, z component of total spin 0 is. I just got it by starting at the bottom, which I could recognize because it has the lowest z component of angular momentum of any of the states, and then applying s plus. Similarly, to get s equal to 1, m equal to 1, yeah, I can guess what that is, but let's see if I can get it this way. All right? Okay, I'm going to have 1 over the square root of s times s plus 1, which is 2, minus 0 times 0 plus 1, which is 0 again. And I'm going to have s plus, and it's going to be acting on 1 over the square root of 2, up, down, plus, down, up. Well, anyway, enough parentheses to close it. Okay, so now there are going to be 4 terms here. One for each of these terms of the superposition, and one for each of the the two terms in S plus, since S plus is S1 plus plus S2 plus. And so I'm going to get 1 over the square root of 2 here, 1 over the square root of 2 here, I get 1 half times S plus 1 times up down plus S1 plus acting on down up plus S2 plus acting on up down plus S2 plus acting on down up. What do I get when I act with S plus 1 on up down? 0. It's the top of the spin 1 half ladder. What do I get here? S plus on this guy. I get up up. What happens when I operate on the when I operate with S plus on up down? I get up up again. And what happens when I act with S plus on the second guy on down up? I get 0, right? I can't raise an up spin, so 0. So I have 2 of these terms times 1 half. Oh yeah, that's up up. Okay, that's pretty cool. That's pretty good. That's worthwhile. That's a useful thing. I can sort of summarize what my results are. I can summarize what my results are. And that is that I have S equal to 1, M equal to 1, which is just up, up. And I have S equal to 1, M equal to 0, which is 1 over the square root of 2, up, down, plus, down, up. And I have S equal to 1, M equal to minus 1, which is down, down. That's great. And these guys form what's called a triplet. The S equal to 1 states form a triplet. And they're orthogonal to each other, but they don't quite form a basis for the state, so the space. Why not? What's the dimension of the Hilbert space of 2 spins? 4. Here are 4 basis vectors right here. So I've missed something. I've missed something. And the something that I've missed has to form a different ladder, has to be on a different angular momentum ladder. And there can only be one of them. So it has to be a ladder of height 0. Of height 0. So what I must have another state, which is S equal to 0, M equal to 0. I have to have another one like this, which is called the singlet. Now, I could probably look at these guys and guess what the other one has to be. It has to be orthogonal to all of these guys. But let's think it through. This is a total spin 0 state. That means the z component of its spin is 0. The z component of its spin is 0. And m is always equal to m1 plus m2. So it must be that this is some superposition alpha times up down plus beta times down up, because these are the only guys with z component of spin 0. It must be a superposition of these guys so that its z component is 0. Okay? Right? You follow? What superposition could it be? Well, I know that this guy, being an angular momentum equal to 0 state, has to be annihilated by S minus. It has to be annihilated by S minus. If you apply S minus to this, it has to be 0, because it's the bottom rung of a ladder of a height one, but that's okay. And I'm going to tell you about, say that you have to think about S minus here, because that's a more general procedure. I could, S plus would be just as good. But S minus, I know that S minus acting on this had better be equal to 0. So let's find out what that is. Let's find out what that means. What is S minus acting on that superposition? And of course, this is going to be the sum of S1 minus and S2 minus. So I'm going to get alpha times S minus 1 up down plus alpha times S minus of 2 up down plus beta times S minus of, S minus 1 down up plus beta S2 minus, this could be up down. Sorry, let's see. I need to make sure I get everything. So there's going to be two things like this. These had better be both the same, and these had better be both the same. All right, there we go. Those are the four terms. And I can see a couple of them are zero automatically. If I try to lower the second guy here, I get 0. If I try to lower the first one here, I get 0. These guys, let's see what these guys give me. This gives me alpha times down, down. And this gives me beta times down, down. Okay, if that's going to be 0, what can I conclude? Right, that beta is minus alpha. And normalizing, I can conclude that this singlet state has to be 1 over the square root of 2 times up down minus down up. And we can see that the singlet state is orthogonal to each of these guys. And that minus sign makes it a total spin 0 state. Yeah?
Why does it only involve the up, down, eigenvector?
Well, the singlet state is an eigenstate of both total spin z, s and also z component of spin, obviously, where these are 0. Okay? And since it's total spin 0, the angular momentum ladder of z eigenstates has one rung. And so if I were in that state and I tried to go down a rung with S minus, I'd get 0. That would have to be true. I can't lower the value of M. I can't lower the value of M because the total spin is 0 for this. And therefore, from that condition, I can arrive at this relation between the coefficients, and then normalization gives me that. Yeah.
Getting something that's orthogonal to all of these as well.
Yes, I could. But in a more complicated problem, where I had not just spin one-half systems, but they spin one systems, then there might be lots and lots of vectors orthogonal to the ones I've written down. Okay? There might be many vectors left over, and so this condition will give me, will work even in a more complicated case. Okay? Because... I'll just leave it at that, and you'll sort of see why. So let me give you the general picture of adding spin systems in the next 3 minutes, and then you'll sort of see where this goes, and I don't want to get too far into it. So let's suppose we got two systems described by S1 and S2. Okay? What do we wind up with? Well, it turns out that the total spin can be more than one different thing. The total spin quantum number could be this, it could be that. The total spin quantum number could have more than one value. And it turns out that in general, S is between the total of S1 and S2, that was the spin 1 case, and the absolute value of the difference, because it always has to be positive. So it can't ever be negative, so I took that absolute value. And in between those, S can differ by 1. So here it could be 1 or 0. In some other case, it might be 2, 1, or 0. Yeah. No, you'll get 2, 1, and 0. They increment by 1. It's between these. It could be as big as 1 plus 1. It could be as small as 1 minus 1. But it's also possible to have 1 in between there, as it turns out. If you work it out for yourself, you'll see that that's a possibility. That spin 2 only gives you 5 states. But 2 spin 1s gives you a total of 9 orthogonal states, dimension 9. So those 5 guys aren't enough. You also need a triplet and a singlet to get a total of 9 orthogonal states. Okay, so that's that guy. And M, of course, ranges minus S to S in each for each of these guys, for each S. And we can M is always equal to M1 plus M2. Because the z component of spin just add. and these total angular momentum eigenstates can be written in terms of the individual angular momentum states, which we might call S1, M1, S2, M2. And that those expansions, that when I expand this state in terms of these guys, I'll have some coefficients, which are, of course, inner products. They look like this. They look like this. S1, M1, S2, M2, inner product with SM. These are the states of total angular momentum, S squared and SZ. These are the individual angular momentum states for the subsystems, the product states. These guys might be entangled, as you can see. These are called Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, they are extremely useful. They can always be found by judicious use of the S plus and minus operators. We can always find these coefficients by judicious use of S plus and S minus. Always. Or we can look them up. But, you know, after you calculated a few of them, you can look them up. These Clebsch-Gordan coefficients are terribly useful because, as you'll see as you go on, total angular momentum is important. Total angular momentum, for example, tells you how a state changes under a rotation. So among all these guys, since this is a total angular momentum zero state, this state is unchanged by any rotation about any axis. These guys might change, but this state is unchanged by any rotation about any axis because its total spin zero. So even just that statement alone tells you that total spin is an important concept. Total spin is an important concept. And it all comes very easily out of the idea that these operators are sums of subsystem operators viewed as tensor products of those operators with the identity on the larger Hilbert space. Questions? Yes? Yes, so there's one that you can get pretty easily. And that is this, that if I have S1 and then in minus S1 and S1 minus S1, if I have this, if I have this as be as small as possible, this is as small as possible, then I know that the total spin here is minus S1 plus S2. Sorry, this is S2 and minus S2. I know that this M is minus S1 plus S2. And the only way that can happen is if this thing is as big as possible. So I know this guy is 1. I know this state is that state. And so I can build from there. That's this argument. I can then apply S plus operators to get all the other values of M right here. And build that method. And then and there's stuff left over. So I go looking for it in the same way among the leftover states. Okay, well, we've run over a little bit of time, but I think this was useful since now you'd be able to work the problem effectively. So, okay. Tomorrow, more great stuff about composite systems and entanglement. Guaranteed. Don't be late. We're going to start right on the tick.